Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Viagogo, Billboard and Jay-Z. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
As ever, we're going to take a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week. A week when the Music Licensing Collective announced some of its key partners.
The MLC being the new Mechanical Rights Collecting Society being set up in the United States of America.
Imagine there being such a thing.
As a result of last year's Music Modernization Act, which is being set up to try and overcome that mad situation we've had in recent years in the US, where Spotify haven't been able to work out what songs are on their system and therefore which songwriters to pay, nor have any of the other streaming services, which means that a portion, I suppose they worked out some of it, but it's quite hard to work out all of it.
Some of it isn't really enough, is it?
Some of it is not enough. So there was a load of songwriters who weren't getting their royalties because Spotify et al. Didn't know who to pay. In pretty much every other country, the streaming services outsource that detective work to a collecting society. But when it came to the mechanical rights in songs in the US, there was no collecting society to do that work. Hence, songwriters didn't get paid. Spotify et al. Got sued for billions of dollars. So the MMA, the Music Modernization Act, is hoping to sort all of that out by setting up this new collecting society, which goes by the snappy name of the Music Licensing Collective.
This doesn't sound like a collecting society, does it? It sounds like a jazz band.
Because of the word collective. Yeah. Well, maybe that's... I'm not sure...
I mean, not a good jazz band.
I'm trying to imagine what jazz band would have the word licensing in their name. But in many ways, this new system that's being set up as a result of the Music Modernization Act should be a much, 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 much better way for the licensing of song rights to the streaming services, more like what is done everywhere else in the world. So in some ways, it's a really good thing, but with one big but.
Mm.
And the big but is, will this collecting society know what songs are being streamed and who to pay? And I mean, all around the world, we've got collecting societies and then hubs that have been set up by collecting societies and indeed some publishers, although they usually outsource it to collecting societies, who are having to do this every month. Okay, so Spotify and all the other streaming services say, okay, ICE in Europe represents PRS, Gamer and Stim and some others. Here's all the tracks that were streamed last month, some of which were new. We've never had them streaming before because they've been recently uploaded by labels and distributors. So you need to work out what songs are in those tracks and who needs to be paid. And so that's happening all around the world. And this new collecting society, that's one of the big tasks that they are going to have to do. And they're starting from scratch. And in some ways, that might have some benefits to it. Because one of the problems with licensing in Europe is you try and take old systems and then sort of mash them into streaming, whereas they get to start from scratch. On one level, that's an advantage. But it's still a massive task for them to suddenly start doing all of this work every month. And so they need help. And so one of the companies that they announced as a supplier to this new collecting society this week is going to help with that task. And that company is called the Harry Fox Agency, which has proven a little bit controversial amongst some of the songwriting community.
For reasons I think would be quite apparent to anyone who's been following this story, because as you said, the problem was identifying which songs were being streamed and who owned them. And the company in the main that was doing that was called the Harry Fox Agency.
Yeah, so the company that certainly Spotify, I mean, there are other companies in the US who will do that service. And not all the streaming services work with HFA, as they are often referred to. But Spotify did. Spotify used the Harry Fox Agency. So Harry Fox used to be, in essence, a not-for-profit business owned by the trade body of the music publishers in the US, who used to do all of this working out who needs to be paid for record companies, because obviously in the CD and download era, that was who had to sort all of this out. And then Spotify hired them. For a few years now, HFA hasn't been owned by the publishers. It's now owned by private equity. But some would argue that it was HFA's incompetence in matching recordings to songs and working out who owns those songs, which resulted in Spotify not paying people, which resulted in Spotify being sued. And among the people who are definitely making that statement is one of the songwriters who did sue Spotify, which is David Lowery.
Yes, he responded to this news of HFA being hired by the MLC with, let's say dismay. He wrote on his website, The Tricordist, HFA did not properly do their job, leaving streaming services exposed to massive copyright infringement lawsuits from people like me. Now they're rewarded with the contract to run the matching of musical works and paying artists.
Yes, and then in this piece, he proceeded to say, Didn't they just fail spectacularly when asked by Spotify to do this job? Didn't the Spotify class action, so that was, there were two class actions, weren't there? There was David Lowery's class action and then another one that got merged together. But didn't that class action and four other private lawsuits, all against Spotify, prove that HFA were incapable of doing this job? So then he concludes, and I guess in this way he's kind of addressing the board of the new MLC. This company, that's HFA, was one of the main reasons songwriters didn't get paid their mechanicals for going on 8 years. And then to the board of MLC, what the fuck are you guys thinking, was his conclusion.
Fair enough.
Well, it was quite interesting when obviously we got the press release through from the MLC announcing these partners. And I mean, they weren't the only partners being announced. There were some other things in that announcement.
No, but that one really stood out.
Well, and then you said, oh, David Lowery's already commented that over on the Tricordist. And I went to check it out. And it was sort of like, oh, well, this makes reporting on this easier for me because I can just quote him saying, what was my initial response to this announcement? So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that, whether anyone else in the songwriting community or indeed the independent publishers will likewise raise concerns with that appointment. And assuming that it all goes ahead, as has now been announced, I mean, will they do a better job of distributing the money? Because the big difference after the MMA is that previously, if you're a songwriter or a publisher who didn't get paid, you could sue the streaming service that hadn't paid you. But under the new system from the MMA, because the streaming services are paying to set up this MLC, the quid pro quo is you can no longer sue a streaming service if you don't get paid, because what Spotify and everyone else will do is, where they don't know who to pay, they'll hand over the money and the data to the MLC and they'll say, well, you work it out. So I suppose what it does mean is there is a central hub where songwriters who feel that they haven't been paid can go and get their money. But if they feel that society is failing, not only will they not get paid, they can't go and sue Spotify to try and get damages. So David Lowery is right to be paying full attention to this, but maybe with the other partners involved in this new MLC, maybe HFA will do a better job than they seemingly did previously when it came to sorting this out for Spotify directly.
Okay, well, we'll see.
We'll see. Anyway, this is not what we're here to talk about this week, although it is an interesting development from the last 7 days.
No, this week we're going to be discussing Billboard's latest update to its chart rules, the latest of many, and Jay-Z suing the maker of a children's book. But first, eBay has announced that it's selling its secondary ticketing business, StubHub. And who is it selling it to? Viagogo!
Yeah, interesting development in the whole secondary ticketing saga in the last week. We knew that eBay, which has owned StubHub, so a big player in secondary ticketing and a particularly big player in the US market, and eBay has owned StubHub since the mid-2000s, so it's been part of the eBay business for a long time. But all throughout this year, we have known that eBay, which was under pressure from its shareholders at the start of the year to do something about its flagging share price, it's been considering selling off various divisions of the business, and particularly StubHub. So we knew that a possible sale of StubHub was coming up. In fact, I think last month, eBay's interim CEO in an investor call had said, oh, we've got an announcement of this imminent.
By the end of January, I think he said.
That's what he said. But I'm not sure there was any indication during any of that that the company who was going to buy it was its main competitor, certainly in the European markets, which is Viagogo.
No, I don't think we were expecting that. I wasn't expecting that.
I think lots of people were quite shocked about this, and particularly those people who have been vocal on ticket touting in recent years and seeking more regulation of ticket resale and the enforcement of existing regulations, I think were quite surprised that, in essence, Viagogo and StubHub were merging. And also, I think, well, maybe not surprised on this, but the fact that this is a $4 billion cash deal.
Yeah.
So Viagogo, from its cave in Switzerland, where it operates officially, has pulled $4 billion out of its back pocket in order to buy its main rival. And also, I suppose, the big thing about this deal is that Eric Baker, who runs Viagogo, was one of the founders of StubHub. Then he left StubHub actually prior to the eBay acquisition, moved to London, and then set up Viagogo, because StubHub originally, its main base was in the US. He set up Viagogo, which then sort of gained a significant market share in the UK and across much of the rest of Europe. So it was sort of like StubHub was bigger in the US, Viagogo over here. Obviously, StubHub has also been very active over here for quite some time as well. But it was very much that Viagogo's focus was not the US. So by buying StubHub, it means that Viagogo, whatever brand they choose to use moving forward, will also be a major, major player in the American secondary ticketing market, as well as in Europe and elsewhere.
Yes, and I mean, this obviously means different things in different places, because it's a global deal. As you say, StubHub is bigger in the US than it is over here. Viagogo is bigger over here. In the UK, because Live Nation's already shut down its secondary ticketing services, there were only Viagogo and StubHub left. And now that means Viagogo is the only one left. So although Eric Baker in his statement was very much, this creates a more competitive marketplace, it was very hard to see how, given that in the UK at least, there's only him left.
Yeah, and I suppose if we look at it from a UK perspective first of all, we know over the last few years here in this country, there has been a big campaign to try and better regulate the for-profit ticket resale sector. So not the companies and the primary ticket sellers that allow people to resell tickets at face value, but the sites that allow touts, or what, obviously touts don't like being called touts, do they? Ticket brokers, as they were probably self-defined, but touts we will call them, to sell tickets on at a massive markup. And there have been lots of moves to get regulations, consumer rights law better enforced in this country. And we saw the Competition and Markets Authority take on that task on behalf of the government. And it then went to what were then the four main sites in this country. So you mentioned the Live Nation sites, which was Seatwave and Get Me In, and then StubHub, and then Viagogo. And obviously, well, ultimately Live Nation just shut their sites down, so they didn't have to comply with the CMA's demands. StubHub, which has been criticised at many points over recent years by those in the artist community and the music industry who don't like online ticket touting, StubHub has come in for quite a lot of criticism. And there was that year, wasn't it, where they sponsored the Q Awards, which, I mean, helped Q make a bit of money out of their awards, but it kind of backfired because half their winners were like, what are you thinking taking StubHub's money? But despite all of that criticism, it has to be said, once the CMA was enforcing the rules, StubHub, I suspect reluctantly, but nevertheless, did fall in line and comply with all of CMA's demands. Meanwhile, Viagogo, well, first of all, ignored them and then fought them ultimately through to the courts. So from a UK perspective, although really the anti-tout campaigners don't like any of the for-profit resale sites, we did get to a point where it was very much StubHub's the good guy versus Viagogo the bad guy.
Yeah, and StubHub really used that over the course of this year, kind of using Viagogo's bad reputation to present itself as the good guy of secondary ticketing, really tried to spin that. So that's another thing that makes it interesting that Viagogo has now bought StubHub. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, like you say, we don't know which brand they're going to use in the future from now on. It could be that one of the reasons Viagogo's done this deal is to ditch the Viagogo brand entirely, which maybe has become a little bit toxic.
Now, of course, Viagogo would argue that although it took longer to comply with the CMA's demands, and it took court action to make them comply with the CMA demands, whereas StubHub ultimately voluntarily did everything that the CMA was asking for, Viagogo would argue, but ultimately we did comply with the CMA's demands. And certainly CMA ultimately dropped their legal action, which I suppose on one level gives some credibility to what Viagogo are saying. Although most of the people who campaign against ticket touting insist that actually Viagogo is still not fully compliant with British consumer rights law, even if the CMA has stopped its legal action against that site. And those same people, even though they're not necessarily big fans of StubHub, would probably agree StubHub is very much the lesser of two evils. And certainly when artists like Ed Sheeran and Lewis Capaldi have been ranting about ticket touting on their social media, they have tended to rant specifically about Viagogo. So I suppose, yeah, if in the UK market, ultimately Viagogo could shift all of their operations over to the StubHub brand, which although it has had issues over the years, has not been presented as enemy number one in more recent times, then that might get people who have learnt not to buy touted tickets on Viagogo back into their consumer base, buying tickets off a website that has the name StubHub at the top.
Another possible reason for the deal is that StubHub has a hold in the US market that Viagogo just doesn't have. And as regulation in Europe is becoming more and more tightly enforced.
Yeah, not just in the UK. I mean, a number of European countries have likewise either been introducing new rules or enforcing existing rules.
And whereas the secondary ticketing market is a lot more accepted in the US And although there have been attempts in different states to regulate, it's definitely less tightly regulated over there. So it could be that Vigo is really looking to just get a greater hold of the US market.
Yeah, I mean, there were rumours earlier in the year that they were expanding their own operations in the US and that they were hiring staff in the US, and that as they were downsizing their operations in some European countries because of these new tighter regulations, that the America was becoming a higher priority. And it would be, yes, an overnight, albeit a involving $4 billion in cash, but it's an overnight way to become a significant major player in, as you say, the market where, despite occasional controversy, in the main, ticket resale is much more accepted as just being part of the live entertainment business.
And $4 billion does suggest that they think there's a lot more money to be made out of this market still.
In their statement announcing all of this, Viagogo said that they hoped that the deal to buy StubHub would be closed in the first quarter of 2020. The deal will probably have to go before certain competition regulators, maybe here in the UK, because as you say, they become the secondary ticketing website in this country. So there may be a few more hurdles for it to cross, and certainly those people who have campaigned vocally against secondary ticketing or in favour of much more regulation of secondary ticketing, for whom Viagogo is definitely by far the worst operator in this space, that is what they would argue. And they, I'm sure, will campaign against this or, at the very least, encourage regulators to really scrutinise what happens at a combined Viagogo StubHub business. Maybe, as you say, if they dump the Viagogo brand and go with StubHub, it will allow a company where it does feel like they have been really feeling the heat in multiple European markets, also in Australia and New Zealand, over the last 18 months. Maybe it will help them gain some new ground. And of course, this wasn't the only announcement this week of Viagogo attempting a bit of a fight back against its critics.
No, because also this week, Viagogo was back on Google Ads, having been banned from the platform in July. Google introduced a load of new rules on secondary ticketing advertising on its advertising platform last year. And for a long time, critics were saying, you've got these rules, but you're not really enforcing them. And eventually in July, Google said, OK, yes, Viagogo's off. It is breaching our rules. And a lot of people thought, well, that's good. Hopefully that's a long-term or even permanent ban. But 4 months later, Viagogo is back.
Yeah, so Viagogo says that it has dealt with Google's concerns in most, though not all, countries. Because I think one of Google's concerns was that Viagogo wasn't complying with local consumer rights laws. Even if it was complying with most of Google's own rules, it wasn't necessarily complying with consumer rights laws. So there is still some countries where there's still a few technicalities so that Viagogo cannot buy advertising on the Google search platform in those countries. But in most countries, including here in the UK, they are back. And of course, the reason why that's quite a big deal is that anti-touting campaigners have said for a long time that the main marketing tactic of companies like Viagogo, not just Viagogo, but particularly Viagogo, is to buy their way to the top of Google search lists. So if you put in Little Mix tickets into Google search, at the top you will find the Viagogo page that is selling tickets for the upcoming Little Mix tour. And because those people who don't listen to Setlist every week and aren't working in the music industry and aren't avidly following Ed Sheeran and Lewis Capaldi's Twitter feed still don't necessarily understand the difference between primary and secondary ticketing, the difference between Ticketmaster and Viagogo, those people are still prone to search Little Mix tickets in Google and then assume that whoever comes top is an official legit seller because they don't understand that you can buy your way to the top of Google search. So lots of people have said that Viagogo buying its way to the top of Google search is part of the problem. And then obviously it hasn't helped over the years because Viagogo then used deliberately misleading language to suggest that, yes, the touts on their platform are official sellers of tickets when, of course, they are not. But they are back in there. I mean, you did a search. And the reason I'm saying Little Mix is you did a little experiment, didn't you, on Little Mix tickets?
Well, yes, because Little Mix had just announced a summer 2020 arena tour in the UK. So I thought, well, I'll search for them because those tickets haven't gone on general sale yet and see what's available on Viagogo. It's quite a lot available on Viagogo. And the advert, like I said, you do that search, the advert for Little Mix tickets comes right at the top above any official primary sellers. And they have changed how they word their adverts slightly. Their adverts used to often say official in them to mean that it was the official Viagogo page for that artist, but it looked like it meant they were an official seller.
Yeah, so they don't do that anymore.
They don't do that anymore, but there are a lot. I mean, the text of the advert says a lot of things like selling fast, deals won't last long, really suggesting that there's a sense of urgency here. You need to come and get these tickets, when in fact, the tickets weren't available from primary sources yet. So there was no real urgency at that point. 9 a.m. the next day, sure, yeah, there's urgency there because those tickets were likely to sell out quickly. But at that point in time, there were lots of tickets yet to go on sale.
Yeah, because the primary sellers hadn't even put them on general sale.
Yes, that's...
So they were selling tickets that didn't exist yet. And again, I mean, that's another important point that the anti-touting campaigners have said, as well as them using terms like official when they're not official. This whole, oh, you got to buy these tickets now, or you'll lose them, means that people who don't really understand how ticketing work are less likely to go and check out the other websites lower down the Google search. And in doing so, probably discover that there are cheaper tickets available.
Yeah.
The same tickets, but at a cheaper price. So all of that urgency thing is about encouraging customers to not go off and do their research and work out actually these are not official tickets and that there are cheaper tickets available on the primary sites. And yeah, that's another criticism of Viagogo, that they are still very much doing, but seemingly are allowed to carry on doing and still tick Google's box. But their critics would say you're still being anti-consumer in using those tactics to try and, well, they would say trick people into buying tickets from a tout.
Google obviously didn't put out a specific statement about Viagogo, but said the general thing about how it monitors what its advertisers are doing and if they're adhering to the rules and would continue to do so. So, I mean, it's possible that Viagogo could get kicked off again, but we'll see. It took a long time for Google to act last time, and I think critics will continue to pile on the pressure for both making sure that Viagogo adheres to actual law and the law of Google, and encouraging both authorities and Google to act if that's not the case.
So yes, after a year in which it did feel like Viagogo was in retreat, certainly in the UK and some other European markets, the last week was a week where it did feel like Viagogo was having some success in fighting back to try and reclaim its share of the ticketing market.
Yes, and we'll see, assuming the StubHub Viagogo deal get through the regulators, what Viagogo then does with StubHub, whether it merges all its operations, whether it keeps the two separate, and whether it ditches Viagogo as a brand entirely. Still to come this week, why Jay-Z has 99 problems with kids learning their ABCs. But now, Billboard has announced yet another update to its chart rules, this time focusing on album bundles, that being when artists and labels sell new records as part of bigger packages that include things like t-shirts or gig tickets. The company says that these changes are an attempt to overcome criticism of the current rules, which allow the counting of bundled album sales that do not reflect customers' true interest in purchasing the album.
Yes, as you alluded to there, this is the latest in a long line of changes to chart rules, particularly in the US, but in actually most other countries as well, as the compilers of charts have had to deal with all of the innovations that have occurred in the last 15 years, as we've seen the shift from physical to downloads to streams and all the different kinds of streams and then all of the other sort of direct-to-fan and online things that are happening that make the selling of albums no longer just about discs being sold at record shops. And each chart compiler around the world has sort of reached its own conclusions on all of these things. None of them have reached the conclusion that this just proves that music charts are a nonsense and we should get rid of them. And I suppose that's not surprising, because even if people in the industry eventually would to come to that conclusion, I guess people who are paid to compile charts are not going to reach that conclusion on their own, are they?
No, I think that is going to be a tough one to crack. But yeah, the charts used to be very easy to compile. You just worked out how many of each record had been sold that week, and then you put it in a list, and everyone was happy, and everyone at the labels got to pop some... Not everyone at the label. Whoever was at number one got to pop some champagne, and everyone else was sacked. But the record industry has changed a lot in the last decade or so, and the way records are sold or not sold has changed a lot. And the charts have really struggled to keep up with those changes and still reflect accurately the popularity of any one release.
Yeah, so although charts still provide labels with those sort of bragging rights you were talking about, the reasons to celebrate if you've got the number one, and I suppose in some ways, I mean, really, the music chart's main reason for being back in the day, beyond the sort of warm glow within the record companies, was that they were a useful marketing tool, because it meant that radio and newspapers once a week would remind everybody what the most successful music of the moment was, and that got everybody another little marketing push. Although it does really feel like that bit as kind of, I mean, does anyone care anymore outside of the industry. I mean, less and less people do. I mean, even Radio 1 kind of shunted the chart into drive time, didn't they, where nobody's really paying attention.
I think the super fans of each artist care about that specific artist's chart position, but I don't think they would know what anyone else's chart position is unless their favourite artist goes to number two and then they can get angry about whoever's number one.
Which I suppose brings us to this latest overhaul of the Billboard album chart. Because yes, people who work at record companies probably still care about the chart. Maybe superfans care about the chart in the context of their artist. But I suppose what we have seen in the last year is that, well, artists still care about their chart position, particularly if they are selling records and getting the streams in such a way that they have a genuine chance of getting the number one position. They clearly feel that having a chart-topping album still means something, even though I think we've done a pretty good job of explaining why it doesn't mean anything. But a lot of artists still want that number one album. And we've had two artists coming out in the last year moaning about the fact that they didn't get the number one position. And in both cases, their moans related to Billboard's rules as to when album sales are counted when the album isn't sold on its own. So the album is bundled together with a ticket or a t-shirt or a piece of merchandise. And that's become quite common in recent years. Often those bundles are sold directly from the artist's website, sometimes through partner websites. And so the chart compilers have had to deal with the question of, well, if it's bundled with a whole load of other stuff, do we still count that as a record sale? When do we? When don't we? And as I say, there were two big artists with big releases in the last year who moaned about Billboard's rules, but actually coming from different directions of when bundles should be counted or not.
Yes, I think the one that probably got the most media attention was Nicki Minaj, who felt that her Queen album of 2018 had unfairly been placed at number two behind Travis Scott's Astroworld because she said the bundles he was selling did not really reflect people buying his album. Particularly, she said he was selling bundles of concert tickets and albums for a tour where the dates hadn't yet been announced. And actually, it was sort of, what he was selling was early access to tickets, and the album just happened to be with that sale.
Yeah, and of course, Nicki Minaj has her Beats One radio show where she moaned about that in quite some detail. At one point in doing so, taking aim at Travis Scott's baby child,
yes,
as part of that. So that's another part of that story. But yeah, that was Nicki Minaj saying those bundle sales shouldn't have been counted. I was deprived my number one spot because people who were actually buying access to a future tour were getting albums that they probably didn't really want as part of that, and I lost my number one ranking because of that. Whereas the second example was the other way around. It was an artist who felt that their bundles should have been counted when they weren't, and that was why he lost his number one position.
Yes, this year, DJ Khaled's Father of a Sad album went to number two behind Tyler, the Creator's Igor album. And DJ Khaled said that was unfair because a lot of his bundles hadn't been counted. He'd been selling energy drinks with the album bundled in, and he claimed that Billboard had originally indicated that it would count those sales, and then when it came to it, hadn't. He alleged that something like 100,000 sales hadn't been counted because of that. Billboard disputed that, but he threatened to sue over that chart position because who could accept a number two? Awful. Like I said, everyone just gets sacked.
He was also annoyed, wasn't he, that Tyler, the Creator, also had a bundle going on around his release and his bundles had been counted.
Well, Nicki Minaj had bundles. Her bundles were counted. Everyone's got bundles. It's just some are correct bundles and some are not, depending on who you talk to. And it tends to be the person in the number two slot who is very vocal about which bundles are incorrect.
So it was in this context that Billboard last week said, okay, we've had a good think about this and we are refining and clarifying the rules around when album bundles will be counted as album sales for the purposes of the main Billboard album chart.
Yeah, so when these rules kick in on the 3rd of January for not only future releases, but anything that is currently out and being sold in a bundle, so everyone will have to comply with these rules from the off. You will only be allowed to count bundles that are sold directly through your own director fan channels as an artist rather than third-party sites. Any merch that you're bundling with your album must also be for sale on its own, and the bundle must cost at least $3.49 more than that bit of merch on its own. $3.49 being the minimum price an album can be to be counted towards the charts. The other thing, and this addresses something that Nicki Minaj was complaining about, is that you can only count an album sale of a bundle once that sale has been redeemed. So once someone has downloaded a download they've got as part of a bundle, or once a physical item has been shipped. Because Nicki Minaj was complaining that people are buying access to Travis Scott tickets. They're getting the album, but they're not actually downloading it. I mean, she doesn't know that. But that's what she was claiming when Travis Scott was selling all these bundles and going to number one ahead of her.
Yeah, so I guess these bundled albums can either be a physical bundle where you get a CD mailed to you in the post, or they can be a download. And I suppose, I mean, you would assume if you bought a bundle from a website, certainly if it had physical merch attached to it, or even a ticket attached to it, you'd have to fill out your name and address as part of that purchase. And presumably, they then mail you the CD. It's not that you have to do something else to get the CD mailed to you. Whereas with a download album, obviously, yes, there's then going to be a button that clicks you through to somewhere where you can actually download the MP3s. And some people have said, in many cases, a certain portion of the people who buy the bundle aren't really interested in the MP3s. Because, I mean, if you're a full-on Spotify or Apple Music subscriber, why would you be interested in the MP3s? So a certain number of people are going through the transaction, getting all the other stuff, but never actually downloading the music, which therefore means, and from the 3rd of January, it will mean that should not count as an album sale.
Yes, particularly if that piece of merch, whatever it is, only exists as part of a bundle, which is one of the things, obviously, Billboard is now trying to overcome. So this seems like a fairly good effort to try to overcome what has been a controversial issue for quite some time now. I think Billboard has been thinking about this for a long time before going public with its new rules. And I assume they've tested how this might affect chart positions of artists currently and how bundles are being sold to advantage their chart positions. And I guess we'll see what effect it has. I mean, I think it'd probably be hard to see what effect it has immediately. The real test will be whether it stops artists complaining about this.
Yeah, does it stop DJ Khaled trying to sue them? Okay. Will be the interesting outcome. So yet another change to chart rules to try and deal with the modern age of music consumption. I wonder how many more of these changes are incoming in the US and elsewhere before we finally give up on charts.
I think we've got quite a few still to come. I don't think that any chart has really dealt with streaming effectively as yet.
No, somebody asked me about that at a conference the other day, and the only answer I had was putting sales and streaming data together is stupid. So we should either have two separate charts or no chart at all. But I'm not sure that necessarily is the solution that the music industry is looking for.
And finally this week, Jay-Z has sued an Australian company that sells books and clothes for children that are influenced by hip-hop and music culture generally, but mainly hip-hop, I think.
Yeah, so the website is called The Little Homie, run out of Australia, although it does have both UK and US-facing versions of the site, set up a few years ago by a woman called Jessica Chia, who was pregnant at the time when she came up with the idea with her first child, and in the About section on the website explains how, when she was preparing for all the changes to her life that having a child would bring, she was concerned that she might be cut off from some of her passions in the past. Huge hip-hop fan. So the whole thing came about with, well, depends how you look at it, isn't it? I mean, you could say, how do I inflict my passion for hip-hop onto my child? Or you could say, how do I share one of my passions with my young children? Bearing in mind that some aspects of hip-hop, certainly when you look at the lyrics, some of the most famous lyrics from that genre, they're not necessarily super child-friendly. So I suppose her attempt was to make some books and some t-shirts that took certain hip-hop acts, certain famous rap lyrics and titles, and then use them on t-shirts and books in a way that would be suitable for children, including very young children.
Yeah, so among the books that this website sells are First 50 Words with 50 Cent, 1-2-3 with the Notorious B.I.G., and A.B. to Jay-Z. And it's the latter of those, as you've probably guessed, that has drawn some legal attention now.
Yeah, so Jay-Z's lawyers have taken offence to a few things on the site, but particularly this book, AB to Jay-Z. So it's basically teaching kids their first 26 words, and like it's quite common in books of that kind, a different picture for every letter of the alphabet, but the pictures are hip-hop themed.
Yeah.
And not only is Jay-Z in the title of that book, but if you turn to the back of the book, obviously, given these are learned words, learned numbers, they're not very big books. It's mainly pictures with a word or a number. I've not actually checked out 123 with Notorious B.I.G. I don't quite know what it is that we're counting as we go through that book. But on the back of A.B. to Jay-Z is the following line, which is, if you're having alphabet problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but my ABCs ain't one.
Which doesn't really scan.
Doesn't really scan. Obviously, a rework of, one of Jay-Z's most famous lyrics. And that is referenced in the lawsuit that has been filed against this company. Jay-Z's lawyers told the Sydney Morning Herald that they initially issued a cease and desist against this website and the woman who runs it about 18 months ago, I think. But no ceasing nor desisting occurred. Certainly, as we record this podcast, that book is still up for sale. Actually, she's got a Black Friday sale, because Black Friday will have happened by the time you hear this podcast. But that nonsense American day that Amazon tried to force on the rest of the world is
successfully.
She is having a Black Friday sale, as part of which AB to Jay-Z is half price. That offer may well be over by the time you hear this podcast, or maybe she would have ceased and desisted by that point now that Jay-Z's team have gone properly legal. But the lawsuit has been filed. But interestingly, she is being sued in her home country, which possibly makes sense. So the lawsuit has been filed in the Australian courts, even though, as I've already said, there are UK and US versions of her website. But actually, the country where this action is pursued, bearing in mind there's a little bit of copyright infringement claim in here, there's some trademark infringement claiming, there's also talk about brand and image rights. Which country you sue in is actually quite important for a case like this, because it's kind of on the edges of copyright infringement and trademark infringement. Because I think there would be definitely an argument to say this isn't really copyright infringement. I mean, that slight clumsy rework of that famous Jay-Z lyric, I mean, is that copyright infringement?
What's Australia's parody right like?
Well, exactly. It does feel like some of the copyright exceptions that exist in certain countries might apply here. That said, of course, as we've talked about before on the podcast, America has its very wide fair use exemption. So, I mean, maybe Jay-Z's people have thought about this and they're thinking, well, OK, Australian copyright law might have some exceptions that apply here, but those are not as significant as the fair use claim in America. So maybe they're thinking, yeah, if we sued in America, they would just say fair use, fair use, fair use. And that is a grey area. We don't want to fight that. So maybe they're thinking under Australian law they have a better chance. But then when it comes to things like image rights and personality rights beyond copyright, there are definitely more options in America than, well, certainly there are here in the UK. And as a general rule, intellectual property laws in Australia are quite similar to here in the UK. So I think there's some interesting questions raised about exactly which bit of law should apply and whether or not this case has substance under Australian law. Would it have more or less substance under US or UK law? And then beyond all the legal technicalities and arguments, there is, I guess, well, it's interesting because the lawyers are saying the existence of this book, AB to Jay-Z, and I mean, in no way does it look like a Jay-Z product. I mean, it looks like every other A to Z kids book. It just has Jay-Z in the title and a clumsy rework of a Jay-Z lyric on the back. And Jay-Z's lawyers are saying, oh, the existence of this book is damaging our client's reputation, damaging his brand. I would almost argue suing this website will do more to damage Jay-Z's reputation than the things that she is selling.
Yes, because it sort of looks like his argument is, I think this is damaging my reputation because it makes it look like I think children should learn to read. Whether he feels like he should have some money for them reworking his work, that's another thing. But it seems very hard to argue that it makes him look bad.
Maybe he's planning his own series of helping kids to learn and count books.
Maybe that's it.
And that's why he thinks it's going to be damaging to his business. But yeah, I mean, I would say, because this is a small independent company, I think the original version of the AB to Jay-Z book, which was one of the initial products that this website was selling, was Kickstarter funded. So, I mean, it's quite a grassroots business run by this woman who's also listed as a defendant in the case. So I do sort of feel that actually he could come out of this looking like the big bad, you know, American multi-millionaire hip-hop star screwing over this little kid-friendly website who has just, in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way, referenced him in a book and on a t-shirt. So therefore, I guess, two elements to this whole dispute. It will be interesting to see how it proceeds, assuming it does proceed in court. One is there actually a case under copyright or trademark or any other form of intellectual right or image right law to actually stop the publication of this and hold them liable for some sort of infringement? And on the other side, from a PR point of view, is this a legal battle worth fighting?
Yes, because I suppose the one thing this has done, and like many cases of this type, it just makes people more aware of this thing that probably not many people really knew about. I don't think this was a massive bestseller.
Yeah, if there are any other hip-hop-loving parents of very young children out there who would like to inflict their music tastes on their kids, now they know they can do it.
Yes, this is exactly the sort of thing that I think I should have known about and haven't. Although, I agree that inflicting your tastes on your children is just a weird thing to do. It's like people who buy, like, banned baby grows. Baby doesn't like Nirvana.
And although I don't think there are baby grows on the clothing section of this site, there are lots of T-shirts for young kids with hip-hop titles or logos or hip-hop style images on them to make it look like your 18-month-old is a big Notorious B.I.G. fan. But some people might like those products. And yeah, as you say, as often happens in cases like this, what Jay-Z has done in the short term, I mean, if he was to succeed in court, maybe he would force his company out of business because it doesn't look like a very big company. But in the short term, it could well result in quite a spike in sales.
Yes, the woman behind the company is, as we record, yet to respond. So perhaps she's just too busy dealing with that spike in sales to do anything about it at the moment.
So I'm sure we will follow this story as it develops, unless they do a sneaky behind the scenes private settlement deal. Of course, a big question for Andy Malt now, given what he's just said about, is it right to inflict your music taste? I mean, are we going to put a link to this website where people can buy that book if they want it in the notes to this edition of Setlist?
Well, you'll just have to go to setlistpodcast.com and find out, won't you?
See which side Andy Malt decided to go on with that one.
Speaking of the show notes for this episode and setlistpodcast.com, you can find the show notes for this episode at setlistpodcast.com. We'll have links to all of the stories we've discussed at the very least in there, so you can read more about anything we've discussed. That's the end of this week's show. It's all we've got time for, but if you do have any comments on anything we've discussed, email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.